All right, everyone. Today is March 26, 2015, and this is a subcommittee on public safety of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. I am going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5516, the Department of Justice budget. Go right ahead.
All right, good afternoon. My name is Steve Lippold. I'm the Chief Counsel of the Trial Division of the Department of Justice. And as you can see from our first slide here, our division is broken up really into four legal sections, which I'll talk about in a moment. There's a fifth section there that is really for organizational purposes, where we house our administrative and our investigators. The mission of the trial division is to defend the state, its agencies and officials in civil matters filed in state and federal courts. The trial division is divided into four sections, and I will explain the role of each of those sections in a moment. The civil litigation section is one of those four sections. The civil litigation section defends the state against a wide variety of claims. For example, tort claims that can be as straightforward as a personal injury claim where someone has sustained a minor injury in an auto accident with a state worker, to very complicated claims where someone alleges perhaps that DHS was negligent in certifying a foster home that led to the abuse of a child. We also handle employment claims where state employees allege an unlawful employment action was taken against them due to perhaps their race, national origin, or because they were a whistleblower. We also handle civil rights claims, persons, often state employees, alleging they did not receive due process prior to an employment action, or inmates alleging that their civil rights have been violated while incarcerated. This section also handles breach of contract claims, where a contractor sues for a breach of contract, arguing it was entitled to additional funds, and also condemnation cases. We handle those cases for ODOT when they are doing road and highway improvement. For a couple of examples that I can give you over the last couple of years, we were involved in a large breach of contract case a couple of years back where a large Portland firm was acting on behalf of one of the nation's most prominent commercial bridge painting companies. The plaintiff sought $2.6 million allegedly owed following a two-year project to blast, clean, and repaint the Yakina Bay Bridge. Though that contractor was paid almost $9 million, it alleged that the contract work was more extensive than had been described by the state, and through a number of change orders argued it that it was entitled to additional funds. The state counterclaimed in that case for warranty repair work, and after a three-week jury trial, the jury returned a verdict on behalf of the state that the state did not breach the contract. Another example would be an employment trial that went earlier this year. Plaintiff worked in a call center for the Oregon Employment Department, answering calls from unemployment benefit claimants. The problem was she wanted to go home early rather than finish her day's work. Management discovered that she had hung up on over 184 callers and failed to document their calls by pretending to be a recorded message. She would say into the phone, "You've reached the Oregon Employment Department. Our hours are 8 to 5. Please call back when we are open." She was discharged from employment, and rather than accept that discharge, she argued that the real reason for her discharge had to do with needing a reasonable accommodation for her insomnia and sleep apnea. The jury disagreed with her position and upheld the termination. The second section for our group is what's called the criminal and collateral remedies section. And let me fix this here. I got myself a little bit ahead on where I was supposed to be. There we go. Criminal and collateral remedies. This section represents the state by preserving convictions gained by Oregon's district attorneys. The cases involve petitions in state court for post-conviction relief, often arguing that the defendant had ineffective assistance of counsel at the trial court level, and petitions in federal court for habeas corpus, arguing a federal constitutional right had been violated. While these matters involve criminal legal actions. The cases are brought in civil court and therefore are handled by the trial division. A couple of cases to give you an idea of the types of work that that section does. A federal habeas action we're currently handling involves Frank Gable. Mr. Gable was convicted of the 1989 murder of Michael Franke when he was director of the Department of Corrections. Mr. Gable has already spent many years litigating and losing his appeals and post-conviction issues in state court, and he's now in federal court attacking his conviction and sentencing and is seeking a new trial. Post-conviction relief cases, we're currently handling the post-conviction relief case of Kip Kinkle, who was the high school student convicted of murdering his parents and two students at Thurston High School back in 1997, as well as attempting to murder over 20 other students at Thurston High School. The next section is defense of agency orders. This section of the trial division defends agency orders that are attacked in circuit court. For example, let's say a Oregon State Trooper has had his license either suspended or revoked for a particular reason, and after the DPSST has made that order, the trooper would like to challenge that order in circuit court. After filing a petition to do so, our section would then defend the agency order on that in that case in circuit court. Finally, the fourth section is what we call our special litigation section, which is really, in some ways, really kind of a part of civil litigation. But they handle some very specific types of cases, environmental cases, elections law cases, and constitutional challenges. Over this last year, this section has defended challenges to the validity of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act in three different cases. The first case was brought by the city of Cave Junction, and that city sued the state, the Oregon Health Authority, and the governor's office seeking a declaration that HB 3460 and SB 1531 were preempted by the Federal Controlled Substances Act. Cave Junction's local code prohibited issuing business licenses to entities that violated federal law because possessing and dispensing marijuana was prohibited under the CSA. The city asserted that the provisions of HB 3460 and 1531 that authorized dispensaries and limit the city's ability to regulate those businesses were preempted by the CSA and therefore unenforceable. The other two cases, one filed by the city of Phoenix and another filed by the city of Cave Junction, raise similar federal preemption challenges. We've yet to receive a ruling on these cases, and they're pending before the court. Our workload. Again, I'll split these up by the different sections that we have. The first one, again, is the civil litigation and special litigation section. These two areas of the trial division handle about 600 new civil lawsuits each year. Plaintiffs in those cases sue the state for over $33 million, which on average is about $450,000 for each individual case. As you can see, the difference in the two biennia from 2011 to 2013, we have seen a significant increase in the cases, in the civil cases filed, about a 20% increase. And what's not on that slide is what we have also seen is due to the complexity of the cases changing over the last several years, the average hours that we spend on those cases is also up about 19%. The criminal and collateral remedies section handles about 400 new suits each year from convicted prisoners. A great majority of these are Measure 11 convictions. We will talk more about what this section does and the caseload there in our next presentation concerning the DCC caseload. Our defense of agency order sections handles about 120 new lawsuits each year. That section is one of the smaller divisions that we have. We've seen a downtick in those cases over this last biennium, and frankly, we're still trying to decide whether that's really a trend or whether or not it's just an anomaly. We're not really too sure. But we have seen lots of cases in that section.
Seeing that downtick, and Madam Chair.
Go for it.
Don't know who has the gavel.
I'm not going to get in your way, Senator. What you need to do?
The interest of whether or not training or some education of the agencies help to actually reduce those trends of some of the cases that come in through relative to the agency. Can you provide us, when you do the detail of what those lawsuits are costing us?
With regard to the defensive agency orders?
Yeah.
Yes, we can do that. I did, co-chairs and Senator Winters, I did notice that yesterday you were asking about some of the training that we have done. And the trial division does work with the agencies that we represent on a regular basis. Oftentimes, some of the best lessons are learned through litigation. And in the past couple of years, we've done a number of things. One of the lawyers who works with ODOT, for example, on a number of their breach of contract cases has worked with them to improve some of their policies and procedures. And as a result of that, we have seen a drop in breach of contract cases with ODOT. As you know, from yesterday's presentation, we have the public law conference coming up. There is going to be a part of our section is going to participate in the employment law part of that to do some training as well to avoid employment lawsuits in the future.
Thank you.
You bet. Okay. Results. The civil litigation and special litigation section have been very successful over the last biennium. We have litigated to a final disposition about 73% of the cases that are handled out of those sections. As you can see on the slide, we've experienced a 95% success rate in those cases that we bring to disposition. Those are cases dismissed, trials won in the courtroom. Of the 5% of those cases that we did lose, we lost at trial. Verdicts paid were $38,000 on average against a demand of about $450,000 per case. That is with one outlier not included in those statistics, which is the verdict we received in December, which was a big hit against DHS for about $3.1 million. 27% of the cases are settled. The average settlement is about $89,000 per case versus, again, a demand of $450,000. Again, there was one outlier there of about $1.2 million that we left out because it skewed the statistics. What we believe that these statistics represent is that we're making good decisions on the cases that should settle and the cases that need to be resolved in court, given the success rate that we've had there. The criminal and collateral remedies section has also experienced very good success. Their affirmed rate is 98%, and the defensive agency orders section has an affirmance rate of about 93%. This next slide is a pie chart, hopefully to demonstrate some of the efficiencies that we have in our in the trial section. We attempt to achieve resolution of cases through litigation or settlement at the earliest opportunity. As you can see, 53% of the cases that come through the door are dismissed on early motions. Those are motions that we make at the earliest possible opportunity, sometimes before we even engage in discovery. We have a success rate, or about 4% of those cases are resolved on summary judgment, and 13% of those cases go to trial and we prevail in those cases. Again, 27% of the cases are settled. Now, the settlement of cases doesn't necessarily happen at the end of the road. Whenever we have a new case that comes in, we sit down with our partner, really, in DAS and with the agency to determine whether a case may be appropriate for settlement very early on in the litigation. We oftentimes engage the plaintiff's attorneys if we think that they have a strong case to see if we should engage in pre-filing or pre-discovery mediation in order to resolve the case early. Sometimes we're successful at doing that. Other times the opposing party is not willing to participate and we have to go from there. Finally, we have 3% of our cases which we did not prevail at trial as indicated in the pie chart. Budget drivers. These are the things that drive what we do. When a plaintiff files a lawsuit, the state must respond, and it's the trial division that responds in those cases. We do not have control over whether those cases are coming in or not. For As an example, we're curious to see if a particular bill that passes this session concerning changes with regard to the statute of limitations for child abuse cases, that there may be a very large uptick in the number of child abuse cases that are filed over the next year. We don't know if we're going to see an increase of 25%, 50%, we're just not sure, but we will be ready to respond to those when they come in. Also with convicted criminals, whether or not they are going to file and bring a post-conviction relief matter or a federal habeas corpus petition, that's going to be up to them and we have to respond. People who lose their licenses, asking for a petition for a review. And then sometimes we have third parties subpoenaing agencies for documents or deposition testimony in outside cases. It's the trial division that coordinates that with the agencies and with the deponents. We also have times when we are involved in public records litigation as well. Other budget drivers really include the complexity of cases. Ordinarily in the civil trial division, we find that there are numerous and varied claims brought within one lawsuit, which turn one lawsuit seemingly into several. Oftentimes we'll have tort claims, civil rights claims, and emotional distress claims built into a single case. We are also experiencing high volume discovery request cases. We're currently involved in a case where we have been required to turn over 470,000 documents. We've had other cases in which we've had over 200 or 300,000 documents we have had to work through, sort through, make sure they're responsive, and make sure we're not turning over any privileged material. We are having some assistance in that respect from our IS department, who is currently looking into new e-discovery software that will provide greater efficiency for our paralegals and our lawyers to be able to wade through those discovery requests when they come in. In the post-conviction relief and federal habeas section, we have seen a real change from the defense bar over the last number of years. We're seeing retained experts being used much more often, which we had not seen in the past, and increasingly long briefing. Due to the DCC budget, which we will talk about here in a moment, they have not often had the financial ability to retain experts to confront the experts that are opposing us. And then finally, with regard to case complexity, are changes in the law. When we have new statutes or legal decisions or perhaps a ballot measure like the legalization of marijuana, we are really kind of walking into new territory. And oftentimes those cases are more complex for that reason. The last slide shows our policy package that we are asking for, which I understand we will be addressing in detail in phase two of our presentation. If there are any questions, thank you. I'll now turn it over to, I won't turn it over to Anna yet. Anna Joyce is our Solicitor General, and she and I will be speaking together on the DCC presentation. Okay. The Defense of Criminal Convictions program is a program separate from the trial division or the appellate division. The DCC budget comes out of the general fund. This is a mandated caseload general fund program that requires the Department of Justice to preserve criminal convictions against challenges in state and federal court. Appeals from the trial court decisions that place criminal prosecutions in jeopardy are handled by our appellate division. Cases filed in civil court to collaterally contest the conviction, meaning a reason different from what occurred in the trial court on a direct appeal, is handled by our trial division. We analyze court decisions and provide crucial information and advice to district attorneys and law enforcement officers. This next slide hopefully will help you to understand how this process works. Because really, once a conviction is put into place, this process really bounces back and forth between the trial division and the appellate division. If you look to your far left, you will see that we begin with a conviction gained at the state trial court level by one of the district attorneys. Direct appeals of a conviction, there in light blue, are handled by DOJ's appellate division and are based entirely on the record created at the trial court level where a county district attorney has obtained a conviction. Here, the defendant, who has been convicted, alleges the trial court made errors on legal issues and as a result should receive a new trial or some other relief, such as a new sentencing. Under this mandated caseload system, DOJ must respond or the defendant will receive the request he or she requests. The entire process typically takes about 2 to 4 years in the appellate courts. Now, if successful, the defendant begins the post-conviction review process there in the turquoise boxes by filing what's called a PCR petition in circuit court. At this point, the case that was handled by our appellate division transfers back over to the trial division. The PCR petition lays out claims of error, the most common of which being that the criminal defense attorney did not adequately represent the defendant during the original trial and or direct appeal process. For this reason, the court appoints or the defendant hires a new attorney to represent the petitioner in PCR proceedings. If the defendant is unsuccessful there, they can appeal that PCR decision. Here, the defendant cannot go back and appeal decisions made in the original trial. He or she can only allege legal errors made at the PCR trial. The case, therefore, returns back to the appellate division, who handles the appeal. This process then repeats itself if the defendant loses the PCR appeal, but the process then transfers from state court to federal court, represented here in the green boxes. If a federal habeas corpus proceeding is filed, the defendant usually raises federal constitutional claims. The case therefore returns to the trial division because it is handled in U.S. District Court. If the defendant loses in federal trial court, he or she can then appeal from that ruling, and the case transfers back to the appellate division for final handling. Now, this process can be extremely time-consuming, and in fact, by the time the ordinary case even gets to the PCR level there in the blue boxes, we're usually dealing with persons convicted of Measure 11 crimes because sentences for lesser crimes already have probably been served by the defendant, and they are out of the system. By the time a person is on PCR appeal or a federal habeas corpus petition, they have generally been serving very lengthy sentences that they have received for heinous crimes or a series of crimes. Generally, we're probably at that time working with people convicted for things such as murder, rape, and child abuse. We believe it is imperative that proper funding support the DCC budget because at each stage, it will be much more cost-effective to properly defend the underlying conviction than chance of conviction being overturned that would cause the district attorneys of Oregon to have to retry a case sometimes many years old. Anna.
Co-Chair Shields, member of the committee. As Steve said, my name is Anna Joyce, and I'm the Solicitor General or the head of the Appellate Division. This next slide that Steve's going to turn to.
There we go.
Thank you. Shows the breakdown of the number of cases between both the trial division and the appellate division. The largest percentage of our cases are those on direct appeal, and that's almost 50% of our caseload, and then the numbers get progressively smaller as the individual moves through the system in the way that Steve just described. I think one of the important things to keep in mind, and Steve again alluded to this, is that we're the respondent in about 95% of these cases. What that means is we have very little control over the number or the complexity of these cases. Between the two divisions, we handle about 1,500 cases a year. For direct appeals, there are really two possible outcomes. The preferred outcome, or the best outcome, is affirming the judgment of conviction and the sentence. And thankfully, that's a result that we're able to obtain in about 89% of our cases. If the conviction or the sentence gets reversed, it means further proceedings back at the trial court level. If there's a new trial or a new sentencing hearing, then the district attorney gets back involved. Often the DA then has to involve the victims, and it costs the state additional resources to have to hold a new trial, a new sentencing hearing, or to undergo further proceedings. So that's why generally we work very hard to ensure that the sentences of the convictions are upheld.
And as we explained a moment ago, co-chairs and the members of the committee, as I explained a moment ago, when these cases move from the appellate court back over to the trial division, again, there's just a couple of probable outcomes that will happen. The petition for relief will be denied, upholding the conviction, and fortunately, as I said before, Our CCR division has a success rate of about 98% in those matters. But if the petition is granted, the same kind of a result will happen as Anna just mentioned. The defendant could get a new trial, have a modified sentence, or some other relief. And again, as Anna just mentioned, we work very hard to ensure that we are being efficient in handling those cases as best we can, because we do believe that money is much better spent at that stage rather than allowing something to go back to the district attorney level.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To go back one slide for just a moment. So did I hear this right, that in terms of the petition for relief being denied, it's about a 98% success rate for the AG's office, is that correct?
Yeah, co-chairs and Representative Gorsuch, that's correct.
And under the petition being granted, so new trial, sure, modifying the sentence, is the idea of reversing something with prejudice maybe what comes under or could come under order other relief, the idea that you're just going to completely take the case out of the courts?
Well, that could I'm sorry, co-chairs and Representative Gorsuch. Yes, that could happen.
Is it fairly rare?
I would say so, yes.
Okay.
It depends on a number of factors. For example, you know, where is the person in their overall sentence with regard to when it might have been overturned? How difficult might it be for the district attorney at that particular time to retry the case if it's many years old? All of those things come into place, and generally those are decisions that are handled at the district attorney level.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Uh-huh.
Please continue.
A smaller proportion of the work that the appellate division does involves state's appeals. We have a committee that takes calls from either district attorneys or sometimes from Steve's folks in the trial division when they have received an adverse trial court ruling that they believe places either the criminal prosecution or the post-conviction proceeding in jeopardy. Generally, the kinds of things we're going to be talking about is exclusion of evidence that is critical to the prosecution, dismissal of charges, things along those lines. We take about 50 of these cases a year, and we generally try to take them to preserve the scarce DCC resources in cases that involve fairly serious charges. Another important function that the appellate division undertakes is supporting district attorneys and law enforcement. We are a clearinghouse for district attorneys' assistance calls, and in fact, I just recently ran the numbers, and so far this biennium, we've spent over 2,000 hours assisting DAs in taking these calls. Oftentimes, the DAs will be in the middle of a trial, a legal issue will come up, they don't have time to do the research, and so they know that they can call our office and hopefully someone is available with a quick answer, or we can take the time to research and point them to a correct legal answer or a new legal opinion that answers the issue that they have. When Mr. Tweet was here on Wednesday, he also talked about the extent to which Criminal Justice Division handles DA assistance calls. Oftentimes, if they don't have the time to research the issue, they will transfer the call over to us, particularly where it involves questions related to recent Court of Appeals or Supreme Court case law. We also do a number of trainings with law enforcement and district attorneys. Generally, we train on case law changes, highlighting particular, perhaps novel legal issues, and giving advice on how they can best handle issues that arise in their work. We also prepare a number of publications. We distribute a weekly electronic bulletin to district attorneys and law enforcement officers that summarizes recent case law from both the Oregon courts and the federal courts. We also produce a search and seizure manual, which is a almost 500-page manual that we produce on a biannual basis that summarizes all of the search and seizure case law, which is an area of the law that is very complex and that changes at a fairly rapid pace. And then finally, we put together the Criminal Law Reporter, which is a compilation of all the cases in the criminal law arena. The goal in all of these, the DA assistance calls, the trainings, and the publications, is to ensure that officers and district attorneys are obtaining convictions that we can then successfully uphold on appeal. Just briefly on the
Can I ask a quick question? And I'm not sure if this should be for Steve or for someone else in the room. If a district attorney is accused of malfeasance in their office, DOJ represents the district attorney in most instances. Is that correct?
Yeah. Co-chairs, Senator Shields, members of the committee, that is correct. District attorney is regarded as a state official. When they're sued for tort actions, they are covered under the OTCA.
And then which pile of money does that come out of, or do you bill them?
That would come out. Co-Chair Senator Shields, that would come out of the risk budget. It would be handled as a risk matter.
The DOJ risk budget or DAS or
DAS?
Okay.
Yeah.
And then DOJ would just get paid its hourly rate through DAS.
That Senator Shields, correct?
Okay, great. Thank you.
Just briefly on reductions, a 10% reduction in the DCC program is about $2.4 million. On a practical level, what this means is for the appellate division, we would have to waive appearance in 240 cases. We would also have to file more briefs that are in sort of an abbreviated or outline form that doesn't as robustly present or protect the state's legal interests. And at the end of the day, it ultimately doesn't save any money, because if the state isn't presenting briefing to the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, it simply shifts the work from our office to the court, and the court then has to do the extra work to try and figure out what the correct legal answer is.
Mr. Chair, just to follow
Senator Winters.
Just to follow up on the question that was asked by Senator Shields on how the DA's how the funds are to represent the DA. Do the DAs pay in to the risk management fund?
Co-chairs, Senator Winters. The risk fund, to my understanding, and this would probably be a better question for DASC and the way they run risk management, is that all of the agencies that it supports pay in as if a premium on an insurance policy. So because the DAs themselves are covered under that budget, I believe they are also assessed a portion from DASC risk.
I think maybe Mr. Boss might be able to answer that question. I see his head bobbing back there.
Something tells me they've thought about this question.
Co-chairs, Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee, Senator William Winters. Yes.
Yeah.
The district attorneys are assessed, and they are considered public officials, so they are covered under Chapter 180 and under the risk policy in the Oregon Tort Claims Act. Mm-hmm. They do receive an assessment. That assessment does essentially, in kind of a broad manner, take the cost of both the attorney's fees and whatever settlements or payouts and amortize it over a period of time. So over, I think it's usually a 3-biennial period of time. So they, in essence, as my understanding, reimburse the risk fund, but it is not all in one big lump.
Follow up. So their assessment is based on reimbursement based on how much is utilized. Is that probably correct?
Co-Chair Shields.
Our experience, the experience of utilization that they have in the fund.
Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee, Senator Winters, yes, that's basically it. Is that,
yeah.
For example, if the attorney's fees and whatever payout was $100,000, they would be paying back the $100,000, but they would essentially pay it in an assessment over time.
Yeah, because there's a differential in payments to the district attorneys, because not all of them share the same amount, because some are actually, as you know, we pay a rate, but then some of them, based on their county, also have an additional pot. So.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right.
Please continue. Thanks, Freddie.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to reductions, for the trial division, a 10% reduction would mean waiving appearance in 45 cases. And what that means is a practical matter is if the state doesn't appear at trial, we're going to lose. So that would mean at a 10% reduction that we would lose 45 cases. That concludes the DCC presentation. If the committee has any questions, I know Steve and I would both be happy to answer them.
No. Please proceed.
Thank you. Moving on to the appellate division presentation. Thank you. So this slide just briefly shows the organization. The division is led by the Solicitor General, which is me, the Deputy Solicitor General, the goal really and the role of the Solicitor General is to work closely with the Attorney General and the other divisions to develop the state's legal position. Unlike a lot of the divisions that have appeared before you in these last few days, the Appellate Division isn't divided up into sections. Instead, we sort of organize around practice area, and that falls really into three categories. One is criminal appeals, one is post-conviction and federal habeas, and the final one is civil and administrative cases. Our mission is broadly defined as representing the state in every case in which the state is either a party or has an interest, and we appear both in state courts and federal courts. We write briefs and argue cases primarily in the Oregon Court of Appeals and Supreme Court, and we have a smaller presence in the federal courts. Before the Oregon Court of Appeals, we are a party in every single one of their in their criminal and post-conviction cases and about 60% of their civil and administrative cases. And what that means is that it gives us a really unique opportunity, particularly in the criminal cases, to work closely with both the court and the Office of Public Defense Services to ensure that we're briefing and arguing and handling these cases in a way that is most efficient and most protective of the funds that we have. Before the Supreme Court, we're parties in about 50 to 60% of those cases. In performing the work before these courts, we try to remain cognizant of the dual role that courts serve in both deciding a particular case and also in announcing the law for the citizens of the state and announcing precedent that is binding on every citizen. Therefore, every time we brief a case, we try both to protect the state's interest in that particular case, as well as to take advantage of the unique opportunity we have to influence the court's lawmaking functions. And in undertaking that role, I think it's really critical to recognize that the Appellate Division doesn't do what we do in isolation. Many of the divisions that have appeared before you these past few days have described particular cases that we work on. Invariably, many of those cases will end up in the Appellate Division. And so we work closely with the other divisions to try to reach out and be helpful as they're handling these trials or contested case hearings to, again, ensure that the results we get at the trial court level are results that we can hold in once it gets to the appellate level. The types of cases that we handle really break down into four categories. We've already talked about the DCC program, and I won't go into that in any greater detail other than to note that that's about 70% of what the Appellate Division does. The other categories are civil cases, administrative cases, and others, and I'll talk a little bit more in detail about each of these. Torts, that's going to sound pretty familiar because Steve was talking about some of those. For instance, wrongful termination. He gave the example of the individual who's pretending to be a answering machine. So if that individual chooses to appeal from the adverse decision that she got, we would step in and defend that on appeal. We also handle juvenile dependency and termination of parental rights appeals. And although sheer numbers-wise, this is a relatively small part of what we do, I do consider it some of the most important work we do because we are protecting children from dangerous individuals and situations. So in those cases, we represent DHS in cases in which a parent has chosen to appeal from an adverse decision from a juvenile court. I know when Ms. Edlin was here yesterday, she talked about the parent whose parental rights had been terminated because he was an untreated sexual offender who had offended against, I think, up to 15 children. If that individual chooses to appeal the judgment terminating his parental rights, we would defend that judgment.
Senator Winters.
What is there the involvement of DOJ during the process of preparing for the termination of parental rights?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senator Winters, yes. So I know the child advocacy section, which Ms. Edlin talked about, works closely with the caseworkers as they're preparing the cases. And then the appellate division, in turn, will often work closely with the child advocacy section as they're going through the trials to, again, ensure that the result we get at the juvenile court level is one that we can uphold when it comes up on appeal. And I think that's particularly important in this context where there are significant concerns about the effect of delay on children. So if we aren't able to uphold these judgments on appeal, we're making things more difficult for the children. The juvenile cases tend to be very complex. They have lengthy records, and they're on expedited timelines. So they are a significant source of use of our resources. State habeas corpus cases are simply cases in which an individual who is imprisoned is challenging a condition of confinement. Generally, what we see is challenges to not receiving a particular kind of medical care that the inmate thinks that they are entitled to. Administrative cases, these are generally cases that involve the Administrative Procedures Act, which is the act that sets the process for how agencies propose and adopt regulations, and then how courts go about reviewing these agency decisions. Some of the examples are listed out on the slide. Again, one of the examples Steve said was the officer who loses his certification through the DPSST hearing. If that individual chooses to appeal from that determination, again, that's where we come in. Other types of cases include a category of cases that are original jurisdiction. That means they go directly to the Supreme Court and bypass the lower court of appeals. Those cases include mandamus cases, which are cases in which an individual is seeking the Supreme Court to order a lower court to either do or stop doing something that the individual thinks is required by law, and that a direct appeal to the Court of Appeals would be insufficient to protect his or her rights. This category also includes ballot titles. So the Appellate Division, by statute, drafts ballot titles for prospective initiatives. And then states' appeals in murder cases. I talked a little bit about states' appeals in the DCC presentation. If the state is appealing a murder case or pretrial ruling in a murder case, those go directly to the Supreme Court, again, due to concerns about delay. Workload for civil administrative cases, we have about 400 a year, and that's a number that's been holding fairly steady. For termination of parental rights and dependency cases, we have about 170. We've seen a slight uptick in this, I think in part due to changes in the law, increasing complexity, and then some changes in how the parents' attorneys are handling the cases. Ballot titles are around 30. That's, again, a number we don't have a lot of control of because it simply depends on how many prospective initiatives there are. Reduction, the most significant reduction I already talked about in the DCC presentation in terms of what it would require us to do in terms of waiving cases. For the appellate, the reduction would largely be taken in our ballot title work, and it would mean that we have about 200 hours less time to spend on preparation of prospective ballot titles. And that concludes my presentation, unless the committee has any further questions.
Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, I'm Fred Boss, Deputy Attorney General. Our next presentation will be concerning the Division of Child Support.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kate Cooper Richardson, Administrator of the Division of Child Support at the Oregon Department of Justice and Director of the Oregon Child Support Program. In administering the Oregon Child Support Program, the Division of Child Support, which is the largest in the Department of Justice, uses four high-level program goals in its strategic plan. These goals provide the overarching framework for the delivery of child support services to families, and they align with DOJ's mission. Increasing support to children and families is job one for us. The Child Support Program operates under federal performance measures, which help focus and evaluate our work to the most effective ends. And the program works with and relies on partnerships with many other entities, including the district attorneys, the Office of Administrative Hearings, the courts, our federal oversight agency, and many other state and federal agencies. And of course, our primary customers are parties to child support cases and their children, customers who are trying to meet the most basic daily needs of shelter, food, and health care. We strive to help them through a difficult time and a complicated legal process with respect and humanity. Here's an overview of the structure of the Division of Child Support, and this org chart represents about 576 employees. The division, like most of the other divisions in the Department of Justice, is divided into three sections. The field operations section is the largest with 12 branch offices around the state. They handle cases where public assistance is or has been received. And for 11 counties where the DA does not provide child support services, this section also handles the private cases where no public assistance has been received. The program services section supports the 12 state offices and the 25 county DA offices with centralized services such as accounting and disbursement of funds, IT support for the mainframe system, and many other centralized teams or specialized teams such as employer services. The policy section includes central administration, federal compliance and auditing, budgeting and statistics, communication and outreach, and policy development. Not shown here, but two other important parts of the child support program are, first, our team of 9 AAGs from the Civil Enforcement Division. In DOJ, child support is both a division and a client, and so this team of AAGs provides general counsel advice and represents the division in court. And then second, of course, are the 25 District Attorney County Operations Offices. These 25 DAs contract with DOJ to provide child support services on cases where the families never received public assistance or where the state debt has been paid in full. The child support program serves everyone who wants or has been ordered to use our services. The division provides child support services for families receiving benefits under TANF, receiving public health and medical services, and when children are in the custody of the state welfare system, including the Oregon Youth Authority. We also receive cases referred from other states because often parents reside in different states. However, aside from referral, parents may also request child support services directly, even when there's no state assistance involved. We often refer to these cases as the private caseload. The DA caseload is almost exclusively a private caseload. This next slide is a sort of Harper's Index of the child support program. It gives you a snapshot sense of the scope and scale of the program, some of which might be surprising to you. Our caseload is greater than the number of minor children we serve because our cases have very long lives, years and years. Many obligated parents fall behind on their monthly court order amount, and so we do pursue child support arrears even after the children have aged out. As you can see, we have a large financial component with the amount of money we process daily. Although historically, Congress created the child support program as a
Senator Wiggins has a question. I was going to let you finish your thought.
You mentioned aged out. How far out?
Co-Chair Williamson, members of the committee, Senator Winters, you have to wave really big to get my attention. aged out, the age of majority in Oregon is 18, but in Oregon, our program serves children up to age 21 if they are in school. We call that a child attending school. So if they are in school at least half time and are making sufficient academic progress, they do receive child support up to age 21. So aged out could be 18 or 21, depending on the circumstance.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. I thought maybe, you know, for those who are still trying to get it after those age, maybe you still provide services to those individuals too.
No, we don't.
Got a question.
Mm-hmm. Representative Krieger. Mm-hmm.
You and I were talking the other day, we won't get into that specifically, but sure. You mentioned that a lot of them get behind. So if there's an arrears amount, pick a number, $10,000 at the time the child ages out, how long is that obligation still in place?
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, Representative Krieger, our orders of judgment have a 35-year expiration of judgment. Any other questions?
So the person, follow up, Madam. So the person could be older than 21.
Co-Chairs Williamson and Shields, Senator Winters, yes, we continue to collect past the age that the children reached 18 or 21 because someone paid for those children to be raised. And okay. We do follow up on that for as long as we can. Very well. So historically, Congress created the child support program as a welfare recovery effort. Most of the money is now going directly to families, which helps avoid public assistance. Regular child support payments can make the difference in lifting a family out of poverty and allowing them to achieve self-sufficiency. As you can see, The caseload has been fairly steady over the years, although we have little control of the caseload that comes to us. The slight dip in 2014 is attributable to a concerted effort in our offices to close old cases that are no longer eligible for services, and also to a decline in birth rate in recent years. Collectively, the child support program caseload is split between the state and the counties, about 3/4 and 1/4, respectively. That's roughly the public caseload and the private caseload I referred to, although my division does have the private caseload for 11 counties. Oregon's case managers handle an exceptionally high caseload, which increases our reliance on centralized services and well-established administrative processes. It also highlights the need for smart automation and business intelligence, which the child support system, the new one, will be bringing to bear so we can concentrate more on those hard-to-collect cases. As one of my fellow child support program directors in another state has said, this isn't your mother's child support program. We do much more than just collecting money. For instance, only a minority of our cases come to the Division of Child Support with an order already established through a divorce decree. So here's a breakdown of our core functions, many of which involve a legal process, either judicial or administrative. Administrative processes have really diminished the burden of hearings on the state court system, and they're more accessible to self-represented parties. The program's active in both the Office of Administrative Hearings, obviously, and in the state courts. So locate is an important component. We need to know and often find where one or another party is and where that obligated parent is working. With a mobile society, that's become more challenging. We use many data sources, the DMV, LEDs, the law enforcement system, the internet, other public sources. A child support order can't be established if paternity is at issue. Many children don't have a second parent on their birth certificate. A child is born to unwed parents. That child must have their biological and legal father established. And in Oregon, 36% of children are born outside marriage. So we use legal processes to establish paternity, which can include genetic testing. Establishment means actually creating a child support order, a legal obligation for the non-custodial parent to pay. Child support guidelines codified in administrative rule are used to establish an obligation that's fair and equitable. The order includes an obligation to provide health care coverage or help with medical expenses. To enforce obligations, we use a number of different tools depending on the situation. By far, income withholding is the most frequent. Modification is a very important aspect of child support. Things change for families over the years. Oregon law provides for a review of each child support obligation at least every 3 years, but parties also have the right to request a review earlier if circumstances have changed. A review can lead to an order being increased, decreased, or even unchanged. We do about 11,000 modifications each year. And as I've mentioned before, we receive, receipt, apply, distribute about an average of $1 million a day in child support payments. And those must be applied to each child support account or family. Many, many payers have multiple cases. So here are some of the tools available for payment of child support and for enforcement of child support orders. Most child support, both current support and arrears, is paid through income withholding. About 70% is collected in that way. That means we work with hundreds of employers and payroll offices, both in the public and private sectors. Tax refund offset is an important collection tool, although the rise in fraudulent IRS returns has complicated this process for child support agencies across the country. The program provides an excellent value for the state's investment. Every general fund dollar is matched with two federal dollars, setting the child support program apart from many other agencies. Our program is outcome-based, measured and monitored by the program and by the federal office, and we reduce state costs by generating revenue for other agencies through recoveries, and I'll speak a little more about that in just a moment. This slide displays the child support program's collection history from 2011. The 2014 collection shows an increase of $4.4 million from last year, and an average of 92% of collections goes directly to custodial parents.
This is interesting because one would think you would have experienced some real challenges, or you didn't go back to 2008 when we began to get into the economic slump. So what challenges did you experience during that period before we started an uptick?
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, Senator Winters. During the recession, many middle-class families even found themselves in with job losses and changes in circumstances. One surprise we found, though, is that because we do income withholding from unemployment, that for those who were receiving unemployment, including that, and because unemployment was extended for a number of I went through a number of extensions, we were still able to collect more child support than we anticipated at first. We also put into place what we called kind of a rapid response to those changed circumstances so that we could process not actual modifications, but temporary modifications of child support so that we weren't putting families under mountains of debt.
Well, one wonders if that also could have contributed, because we've seen a huge uptick in SNAP during that period. So if we're reducing the income or the abilities at one end, you know, it may have an effect on the other end, on the ability to purchase. So just wondered what you had experienced during that period.
Madam Chair, you mentioned you collected $1 million a day. Let's just say of that million, $100 was received from Sam to go to Mary. Does Mary get the $100, or is there anything deducted out of that for collection costs by anybody at any point in the process?
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, Representative Krieger, we have a $1 application fee one time, and for private caseload only. So for folks who have not been on public assistance, we do charge $25 a year only if we collect more than $500. So in most cases, no, there are no charges. Okay. Very well. Our performance measures, as I mentioned earlier, our program is performance-based. We continue to increase our performance in collections. Cumulative collections increased by $3.6 million in the last year, and arrears collections increased by $4 million, or 4.6%. So here's a fun fact that I like to share with my staff and you. In 2014, an average of $513,630 was collected for each child support program employee. That helps make it meaningful when we're working with thousands and thousands of cases. So we're leveraging technology and working smarter wherever we can. Because in 2014, we have 30 fewer positions in our program than in 2010. But our total collections has gone up by about $14 million. Walking through the performance measures, current support collections is money that's collected and distributed in the month that it's due. Even one day late makes it arrears. Cases with payments on arrears is the number of cases with past due support that received a payment toward the past due amount, and you have to pay current support before you can pay on your arrears. Order establishment measures the number of cases in the program with an established support order in place. The paternity performance measure measures the total number of paternities established in Oregon this year divided by the number of last year's births where paternity was at issue or not established at birth. It's a complicated formula. The cost-effectiveness ratio is the amount of money distributed for each dollar spent on the program. So in 2014, for us, that was $5.18. So breaking that down of that $5.18 $4.69 went to families, and then 49 cents, or about 50 cents, went back to federal and state agencies. So taking that a step further, 50 cents of every taxpayer dollar spent on the program comes back to the taxpayer for reinvestment. So our budget drivers, and the first two here have had the most, the largest, most recent impact. Our aging child support system does definitely increase our workload. Even little upgrades take more time, and many changes or minor changes lead to system problems. So we're in a multi-biennial process of addressing that, and I'm going to discuss that in just a moment. The program handles federal tax information, and the Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement has strict confidentiality requirements. IRS and federal confidentiality laws have really significantly increased in the most recent years, both for physical sites and for data security. Those changes that are required to our system and even to our buildings have made some real impacts on our budget. So here are some changes we've experienced recently. We've absorbed more work among fewer persons, and so that's taxed our current employers. And then in December of last year, the Klamath County DA decided that, all things considered, the state could provide child support services more efficiently and cost-effectively for Klamath County constituents. And so we've made a smooth transition from the DA's office in Klamath County to our Medford office.
Question. Representative Krieger.
As we indicated the other day, you do the collecting in some counties, and some counties the DAs do it.
Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Shields, Representative Krieger, that's correct. We 25 DAs offices around the state also provide child support services under the umbrella of the Oregon Child Support Program, and for 11 counties, we our offices do it, our state offices do it.
Where does all this where does all the statistical information that you're providing, is it ever lumped together in a place as to what the, where the DAs are doing, how many children they're serving a year, how much money they owe, how much has been collected, and how much is behind? Do we have that?
We do. I have a lot of statistics right here. Co-Chair Williamson and Senator Shields and Representative Krieger, but I have a whole team of my performance budget and statistics team that can gather, can slice and dice as much information, I think, as you'd like.
Could you go back to 42? And just elaborate a little bit more on the budget driver on the lower wages for parents and the higher incidence of under or none employment. And just a little more clarity, please.
Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Shields, Senator Winters. Yes, when you have economic insecurity, that stresses the entire system for the entire social network system, but including our child support system. Parents have lower wages and higher incidence of unemployment or changing employment or underemployment. That will reduce the support that's collected and distributed, which that impacts collections for families and for recoveries for state agencies. It increases the needs for modifications.
So the uptick that we're seeing, are the employment statistics that we're seeing of the reduction in the unemployment rate, that you're suggesting that that employment is probably at a lower wage level. I'm trying to get, you know, this the parallel for where we are with the employment division's statistics that they just, I think we're now probably getting close to national average on the unemployment rate, which is 5.6 or something, somewhere in that ballpark. But are you saying that even though we are seeing that we're seeing lower wage jobs?
Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Shields, Senator Winters, indeed, I think that is probably true. It's difficult to take, we have to kind of extrapolate that information. We are seeing more parents employed. I will say in our collections and changes in unemployment, either direction, it takes a while for those changes to show up in our statistics, generally it takes about 12 to 18 months. So our collections appeared higher just because it takes a time to process through when the economy started down and unemployment started going up. The same is true as it's heading back up. Anecdotally, I will say that there seem to be a greater number of lower wage jobs.
Because your fiscal year 2014 looks pretty good in comparison to, because you've had an increase. So you're anticipating 2015 to be down in collections?
Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Shields, Senator Winters, I don't believe it will be down. I think we won't be seeing the same uptick that in numbers that we would have hoped as far as increased dollars. Because there are so many cases, though, so, you know, hundreds of thousands, it's very difficult to narrow down all the various variables and tie it to a particular.
But you track your collections probably on a monthly or basis, right? So you would have what you see the first quarter, second quarter, and the third quarter in the year. So it doing a comparison between the 2015 first quarter, which would be ending in March, how does that look?
Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Shields, Senator Winters, I can pull this the particular unaudited.
Yeah, because I'm trying to track mm-hmm. honestly if we are in fact taking the Employment Division's stats that they're giving us, and then I'm reading, you know, the expectation for your division that it's anticipated that because of lower wages for parents that you're going to see a reduction in the amount collected, and I'm just trying to balance what's going on between jobs and what your agency would predict. So to me, it would be helpful to have your quarterly analysis to see just what really is taking place.
Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Shields, Senator Winters, I hear what you're saying. I will say that we can provide you those collections. I'm not sure how much that will be able to tell you. Frankly, we don't have a system that allows us to drill down, and the business intelligence enough to drill down to very specific information, but we will provide the general information for you. And truly, with our new system, when we are able to pull some of that business intelligence forward, that will help us a lot also in understanding the populations that we're serving. All right. So let's talk a little bit about some of the efficiencies. I said that we were trying to work more efficiently and provide good service to our customers, which is, of course, a win-win. Our business process re-engineering was a necessary step before designing a new system. We don't want to design something we don't want to have business processes that are workarounds off an old system and design it for the and build those workarounds into our new system. The employer portal that we offer now allows employers to manage their child support business online in a secure environment. And we've made it easier to pay for child support online and at kiosks around the state. So I'm going to talk a bit more about our policy package than my colleagues have done, because it's a continuation of last biennium's package and because it represents a lot of what the Division of Child Support has been and is doing right now. Our current child support system, which is a multifaceted system that handles case management, legal actions, document generation, accounting and financial systems, was designed and implemented in the 1980s based on COBOL programming, and it's one of the oldest child support systems in the country. So here are the steps that the Division of Child Support have gone through on this project to date. The year-long feasibility study by an independent expert vendor developed the business case and identified what sort of system Oregon needs. We went through the business process re-engineering study also with a vendor, as I just mentioned. The last session, Thank you very much. This committee and the full Ways and Means Committee and Legislature approved us to move forward with the system project, financing the state's one-third contribution through capital bonds. The feds, thank you very much, are picking up 66%. Right now, we're preparing for design and development of the new system by reviewing all of the to-be processes, so what we want our processes to be that we determine from our business process reengineering. We're reviewing those to determine whether a law or rule change is necessary, and also to review all the associated forms. We have thousands and thousands of forms. Maximus was selected to be our project management contractor to work alongside DOJ in managing such a large-scale project. And their staff joined us, or their first of their staff joined us October 1st, and they hit the ground running with development of foundational documents, and their business analyst team is going to be joining us next month. Also, a notice of intent to award was sent to Deloitte for the system integrator contract just last Friday. It's kind of big news.
Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. Did you consider and look at off-the-shelf systems?
Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Shields, Representative Wisnett. Yes, except there really isn't an off-the-shelf ACOT system for child support systems. The Florida just put in a new system and has referred to it as a COT system. It is in some ways, but there really isn't. It's such a specialized area with so many federal certifications around it that while there are experts in developing those types of systems around the state, there isn't a single off-the-shelf product.
Just a follow-up comment. Well, good luck. I think everyone knows that eCourt off-the-shelf system has been very successful. And we haven't had good luck on other computer systems. Good luck.
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, I plan to not just use luck. I'm hoping for a lot of luck, but we've got a lot of skill at the table. And for those, not this table specifically, really, all this behind me. We also recognize that this is unlike anything the Department of Justice has ever done before, and that's one reason we brought a project management contractor in, because while we plan to maintain our control over the project, we know that the expertise lies outside, and we will work in partnership to make sure, and it's my intention to show the state that we can do a very complicated project like this.
Thank you.
The final contract for our quality assurance contract is under DOJ legal review right now before being sent to CSG Government Solutions for signature, and we're targeting a March 1st start date. And we've also received proposals for the what we call the IVNV, the Independent Verification and Validation Contractor, which is required by our federal partners. And those three competitive range proposals will be in Oregon to interview early next month. So I'm not a fan of acronyms or initialisms, but JAD and also JTD, they're very helpful. They stand for Joint Application Design and Joint Technical Design. So we've got training development already underway in preparation for training dozens of our program functional and technical subject matter experts, and they will be contributing during the design phase of the project. Developing clear and detailed requirements is really critical to the success of this project. This just gives you a picture of the multi-agency steering committee for the projects with representatives from DHS, Oregon Health Authority, eCourt, OJD, ODOT, and others. And their expertise and experience is also invaluable. And this committee meets monthly. In the next biennium, we'll wrap up bringing on board the contractors. And among the first deliverables for the system integrator is to stand up a project facility to house the entire project team, including integrator staff, project management and quality assurance contractor staff, and all the program staff dedicated to the project. I will add that the project costs contemplate that we want our own program staff to be those subject matter experts and to help in the design, and the project costs contemplate filling behind so we can keep doing our daily business and get those funds out to the families, even while handling such a large project sort of on the side.
Did you give us a projected cost of the program developing yet? Total cost to the vendor?
Co-chairs Williamson and Senator Shields, Representative Krieger, the total all-in cost are in your budget documents for this biennium. You'll see those project costs. We are in contract negotiations right now, with our system integrator. But the cost proposal, I'm going to double check, came in around $75 million for that piece of it, and then there were other project related. The contractors also, we will be rebaselining the project budget and schedule as soon as we have all of our contractors on board. Okay, so the JAD and JTD sessions here, the thoughtful planning that takes place now, is going to be there to provide quality training to those functional and technical subject matter experts, and it's really imperative that they understand the important role of eliciting, clarifying, and validating the hundreds and hundreds of functional and technical requirements that will be used to deliver the system functionality to meet or exceed the project goals. The system build, it's also referred to as the development or construction phase of the project, is scheduled to begin in 2016, and user acceptance testing is scheduled to begin in 2017. And of course, a reduction. I'll just say that a reduction in our program would, it has a 2-for-1 loss in that we lose matching funds from the feds at the same time, and that would result in the loss of 60 positions throughout the Division of Child Support, which would have a cascading effect in slowing down those legal actions, collecting less money, and getting not getting money quickly and efficiently to families. So that concludes my presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Oh, just one.
Yes, Representative Krieger.
The charges that you do for sending that check to John, is it the same at the county level, or they charge a different amount for collecting the money than moving it across to the parent?
Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Shields, Representative Krieger, it's all done under the umbrella of the Oregon Child Support Program, and so it is all the same charge or no charge, as the case may be.
Okay. All right, any other questions? So what's next, Mr. Borden?
Thank you very much.
Madam Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee, a couple notes. The agency has responded to Monday's questions that you've had, and those are posted out there on Monday. They're working diligently on the remaining questions. Yesterday's hearing and posted under the website is the A engrossed version of that Senate Bill 222 that was referenced. That's the juvenile dependency representation issue. And so on Monday, you'll have the wrap-up from the agency. You'll have the CFO's office presentation and then public testimony, and you'll be finished with the agency.
Great.
So.
All right. Anything else? With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5516, and we are adjourned. Okay. See you all on Monday. See you all on Monday.